This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 17, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. Concern grows at the number of accused U.S. soldiers that reach plea deals over atrocities committed in Iraq. France's Socialist Party picks the first woman to stand a real chance of winning the presidential post. And as many as 20,000 people gear up to participate in the 17th annual School of the Americas Watch in Fort Benning, Georgia. We'll bring you those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. After months of rejecting an expanded peacekeeping force, the Sudanese government has agreed to a United Nations presence in Darfur. FSRN's Emmanuel Okella reports.
During a UN-convened meeting yesterday at the African Union headquarters in Ethiopia, Khartoum agreed to an expanded United Nations package of support for the African Union force that is currently on the ground in the Darfur region. However, sticking points remain. Sudan insists that the expanded force must be African-led, African-manned, and African-controlled. That could be a potential deal-breaker for UN members who want more say in the operation. Currently, a force of 7,000 African Union troops patrols the region, but many observers say the force is too small and underfunded to prevent ongoing bloodshed. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan was optimistic about the breakthrough.
All the participants came with the right spirit, the right mood, and a determination to find a solution, realizing that we cannot maintain the current impasse.
The deal could lead to the deployment of 17,000 troops plus 3,000 police, but Khartoum hasn't signed on that yet. Final details of the agreement are to be discussed at a meeting next week in the Republic of Congo. For Free Speech Radio News, Emmanuel Okella reporting.
Representative John Boehner of Ohio has won the position of minority leader in the 110th Congress. Roy Blunt also kept his leadership position and will be the minority whip of the House of Representatives. The Republican leadership elections for the House of Representatives firms up the House and Senate leaders when lawmakers begin a new session in January. In other news from Washington, D.C., women's groups are voicing concerns about President Bush's choice for the new head of the Family Planning Program at the Department of Health and Human Services. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Eric Kerouac is the current director at A Woman's Concern. It's a Christian women's center that discourages contraception and promotes abstinence. He was appointed to oversee the Department of Health and Human Services Family Planning Grant Program, which awards nearly $300 million to programs focused on families, teens, and low-income people's pregnancy prevention. The appointment, which does not need Senate confirmation, disturbs women's choice groups. Olga Vives is Executive Vice President of the National Organization for Women.
This continues to show the arrogance of this administration in that they apparently did not listen or realize that this country wants change.
The hiring of Kerouac comes the same week the president renominated six conservative judges who were previously unable to pass through the Senate confirmation process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The country's largest owner of radio stations, Clear Channel, has agreed to a buyout for a reported $18.7 billion. One of the two major investment groups involved in the purchase of Clear Channel has been accused of violating Securities and Exchange Commission disclosure requirements. Mark Taylor Canfield has more from Seattle.
Thomas H. Lee Partners is the world's second largest private equity firm, specializing in leveraged buyouts. Private equity firms are currently the target of a U.S. Justice Department investigation into possible antitrust violations. Shareholders filed a lawsuit this week in the Manhattan Federal Court accusing Thomas H. Lee Partners of illegally conspiring to drive down the prices they paid when taking companies private. Media activists in Seattle claim that Thomas H. Lee Partners' history of litigation for unethical business practices does not bode well for the legal and financial future of the Clear Channel properties, which have dominated the U.S. media. This is Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle for Free Speech Radio News.
In Uruguay, a former dictator and ex-minister of foreign relations have been arrested. They will both face charges of involvement in the murder of their regime's critics. Asli Pellet reports from Montevideo.
A judge ordered the arrest of the two former officials yesterday. Ex-dictator of Uruguay, Juan Maria Bordaberry, soon after turned himself into the police. His then-Minister of Foreign Relations, Juan Carlos Blanco, was arrested immediately. The men are accused of involvement in the killing of two left-wing politicians, Zelmar Michelini and Hector Gutierrez Ruiz, and two militants, Rosario Barredo and William Whitelaw, who were executed in Buenos Aires in 1976. The Uruguayan judge ordered 10 years of prison for both men without possibility of early release due to the seriousness of their crimes. Some 180 Uruguayans were killed during the 12 years of military rule. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Asla Pellet in Montevideo.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
News outlets were full this spring with allegations of brutalities committed by U.S. troops in Iraq. Now, many of those soldiers are facing their day in court, but some observers are concerned at the number of accused who have reached plea deals with the military. FSRN's Aaron Glantz reports.
This spring, the Pentagon announced that a group of Marines went to the home of a 52-year-old disabled Iraqi, took him outside and shot him 4 times in the face, and then framed him to look like an insurgent. Now, many of the soldiers involved are in court, but 4 of the accused have reached plea agreements with military prosecutors. Gary Solis is a former prosecutor at Camp Pendleton who teaches at Georgetown University School of Law.
These are not just pretrial agreements with an offer with an agreement for the accused to testify. The accused gets, in a sense, 2 deals. First of all, he pleads and gets an assured sentence that is shorter than he might otherwise get. For example, at Camp Pendleton, an accused pled and was sentenced to 18 months, and the judge, had there not been a pretrial agreement, said that he would have sentenced him to 5 years. But in addition, they're pleading to reduce charges.
This week, for example, Lance Corporal Jerry Shoemate pled guilty to charges of aggravated assault and conspiracy to obstruct justice in connection with the killing of the disabled Iraqi. Shoemate will serve 18 months in prison. His attorney, Steve Immel, would not speak on tape for this story, but said the prosecution, quote, showed maturity in understanding how difficult and dangerous it is to be an American soldier in Iraq. That outrages Gary Solis, the former prosecutor at Camp Pendleton.
Who is representing the deceased in these cases? Who is looking out for his interests? If everybody gets to plead to reduce charges, is the justice system working as it should?
Another problem, say watchdogs, is that a very small percentage of crimes committed by U.S. troops result in prosecution. Rahul Mahajan runs the blog Empire Notes. He talks about one case in Afghanistan.
Look, for example, at the case of 2 young men killed in Bagram by repeated strikes to their bodies that basically destroyed their tissue on large parts of their bodies, and where the coroner actually wrote down the cause of death was homicide. 27 different soldiers were involved in killing these 2 men over a period of some weeks. Nobody has been charged with anything more than minor crimes because the final upshot was they said that since they couldn't determine which strikes actually ended up killing these people, they couldn't charge anyone for murder, which is the kind of argument that, you know, would never fly in a million years in an ordinary civil murder case, but flies because the military makes up its own rule.
It's difficult to know how many Iraqi and Afghan civilians have been killed by the U.S. military. Sarah Holwinski, director of the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict, says that while U.S. law entitles victims to file claims with the military, many Iraqis do not for security reasons.
The country is in such disarray that it's very hard for people who have been harmed by U.S. operations to actually go to the claims offices. They can't travel outside of their homes or neighborhoods, and certainly as soon as they go to a claims office, they might be targeted or kidnapped.
A Pentagon audit of one emergency fund found the military provided more than $14 million to civilians in 2005 in compensation for death, injury, or property damage. But the audit does not show how many families were compensated and does not reveal how many were turned down and why. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
France's Socialist Party has chosen Ségolène Royal as its candidate for next year's presidential election. As FSRN's Tony Cross reports from Paris, she's the first woman to stand a realistic chance of winning the post.
I would simply vous dire tout le bonheur que je ressens. Voilà, je suis très heureuse.
Ségolène Royal thanks her supporters after hearing that she's won the Socialist Party nomination, with over 60% of party members voting for her. She left the two other candidates, former Finance Minister Dominique Strauss-Kahn and former Prime Minister Laurent Fabius, trailing with 21% and 18% respectively. Political differences were difficult to make out during the televised debates that preceded the vote, with all candidates swearing loyalty to the party's programme of modest reforms, such as raising the minimum wage, full employment, and sustainable investment. Despite a far from radical record in office in the mid-1980s, Fabius campaigned as the left-wing candidate. One of his supporters, Claude Bartholomé, put Royal's victory down to massive publicity and the support of thousands of newly enrolled party members.
We were served up nearly 30 opinion polls, and new members made their choice in isolation from the rest of the party. But that's not so important now. What matters is this nomination and the will of the socialists to join together to win the presidential election.
Royal won't be the first woman to stand for president. Trotskyist Alette Laguiller has stood six times. But she is the first woman to stand with a chance of winning, and that's boosted her image as a breath of fresh air in France's political atmosphere. But apart from proposals to stop government aid to companies that relocate outside the country, her politics seem to veer to the right of the socialists' official line. They include questioning the value of the 35-hour week, introduced by her own party, and proposing boot camps for young delinquents. The former director of Le Monde newspaper, Henri Fontaine, hopes that she will be France's Tony Blair.
She thinks by herself. She's not a slave of a party's slogans. Very frequently, it's easier to make a slightly rightist point when you are labeled leftist. France has not yet made a Blair or a New Labour mutation, and I think she's probably ready to do that. Look at what she has said about the 35 hours a week. It shows that she's not linked by the usual speech of her party.
The mainstream right UMP has not yet chosen its candidate. Controversial Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy is already running an unofficial but much publicised campaign. And far-right leader Jean-Marie Le Pen is already in the race. In 2002, he made it through to a runoff against mainstream right-winger Jacques Chirac. These two opponents may well rally left-leaning voters around Royal when it comes to casting their ballots next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
An Asian human rights group has condemned the Philippine government's failure to investigate a growing number of extrajudicial killings and forced disappearances in the country. The Asian Human Rights Commission has also called on authorities to look into the cases of forced disappearances with the same urgency as political killings. As FSRN's Gurley Linau reports from Manila, families of disappeared persons are appealing for urgent help in hopes that their relatives are still alive.
4 years ago, Dibat Nagay Rosso, a mother of two young children, lost her husband when gunmen abducted him in the northern Philippine province of Nueva Ecija. Up to now, Ayroso's husband, Honorio, has not been found. Honorio was organizing for the leftist party list group, Bayan Muna, when he and fellow activist Johnny Orsino were abducted by armed men on February 9, 2002. In 1989, Honorio was also forcibly taken by soldiers, who detained and tortured him for 10 days before charging him in court for allegedly being a communist rebel. He was later acquitted and released. Ayroso fears that her husband would not be as lucky this time.
Nung umpisa ganun eh. Pero yung mga kwento niya nung na-recall ko yung...
At the start, I was still hopeful. But when I recalled his stories about his first abduction, the torture, then I remembered what he said then, that if he was taken again, he will no longer come out alive. It's difficult to accept that he is no longer coming back. While I know he is not coming back, it is more difficult to accept that he is already dead.
Ayroso and many other families of missing persons believe that soldiers or policemen were behind the disappearances of their relatives as part of a campaign to eliminate persons critical to the government. Since the first case of a forced disappearance was recorded in 1971 during the dictatorship of Ferdinand Marcos, more than 1,800 people are now missing. Many of the victims are human rights advocates and workers, leftist activists, and labor leaders. Michael Anthony, program coordinator of the Asian Human Rights Commission, said the forced disappearance of even one person was alarming and should be investigated by Philippine authorities. In a fact-finding mission in the Philippines in July, Anthony said his group found out that a task force created to investigate extrajudicial killings is not looking into the increasing number of forced disappearances in the country.
The head of this unit, when asked about whether or not they were investigating forced disappearances, stated that they need to have a body to launch an investigation. So they are not at all treating the question of forced disappearances. And this to me is a very significant problem. The people that are conducting these killings only need to ensure that the body of a person is never found to basically ensure that there are no effective investigations of any type into these events. Added to this is the possibility of people still being alive when they disappeared. So we would hope that investigations would be able to find these people so that they are not killed.
Guy Portajada, spokesperson for the families of the Desaparecidos for Justice, said the incidence of forced disappearances has again worsened under the administration of President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo since 2001. There are already 186 victims of forced disappearances in the past 5 years. Portajada herself is a victim of forced disappearance, with his father, a labor leader, missing for the past 19 years.
I really hope that the government will take some kind of action to stop these abductions of its citizens. Instead of taking its citizens, the government should take care of their needs. But I guess this is really what they want, to silence those against them. But that's where the government is wrong, because entire families are enlightened when a relative becomes a victim of forced disappearance.
As families continue to search for missing relatives, even 2 decades after they disappeared, leftist lawmakers are now pushing for the passage of a new law that would compel authorities to conduct investigations on reports of forced disappearances. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Gurli Linao in Manila.
Junin is a community within Ecuador's Intag cloud forest region, a place considered to have one of the world's greatest biodiversity. But it's also the site for a proposed open-pit copper mining project by a Canadian company listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange. As Kasim Termizi reports, residents of Junin and surrounding communities are resisting the proposed mining project.
Ascending Copper Corporation, a Canadian company involved in exploration and mine promotion, acquired the mining concessions in Junin in 2004. Companies like Ascendant perform feasibility studies and mine speculations, and later sell the project to larger mining companies. Jose Garzen is a farmer and the president of joint parishes of the township of Cotacachi. Intag is a part of the township of Cotacachi.
Al Ascendant, por muchas asambleas, muchas reuniones, se le ha dicho fuera.
In many assemblies and town hall meetings, people pronounced that Ascendant should leave and that we want peace. On May 20th of this year, there was an assembly for the zone of Intag, where a similar resolution came out rejecting the mining project. There were about 800 people in this assembly, and they rejected the project. Of course, there was a group who supported the company, but they represented no more than 25 people.
No habría más de unas 25 personas que apoyaban a la empresa.
According to the Ecuadorian constitution, the government must first consult with communities that will be affected by the environmental impact of a project like an open pit mine. Residents opposed to the project say that no such consultation took place when the transfer of the Junin mining concessions took place. A court later decided to allow the transfer of concessions. According to local media reports, on November 1st, about 60 people working for an agricultural company contracted by Ascendant Copper to apparently do farm work tried to enter 2 towns in Intag. Opponents of the mining project say that the so-called agricultural workers physically attacked local mining activists when the locals asked about the workers' business. Residents say that the workers had tear gas canisters, firearms, and machetes with them. Edmundo Lucero is the president of the town of Junin. He explains why he thinks the reported attack is part of Ascending Copper's strategy to force the mining project into the area.
La empresa lo que ellos quieren es dividirnos.
The company wants to divide us, provoke us so that we react, so that they have options to bring us to court, to have warrants for the arrest of leaders fighting the mining project, in order to send them to jail or make them run away. Also, they are trying to provoke us so that they have reason to bring the military into the area.
Opciones para que haya una tres militares aquí a la zona.
In the 1990s, new mining laws were introduced in Ecuador that were to support increased investment. Ricardo Buitrón of Ecological Action, an Ecuadorian environmental organization, comments.
Here, mining law reforms were done with the financing of the World Bank. But not only that, the mining law reforms were written by the lawyers of mining companies.
According to recent reports, Ascendant Copper hopes to begin drilling once an environmental impact study is completed. Opponents of the mining project say that they will continue resisting. Reporting from Junin, Ecuador, for Free Speech Radio News, I am Qasem Termizi.
This weekend, the 17th annual gathering of School of the Americas, or SOA Watch, outside the gates of Fort Benning, Georgia, is expected to draw a record crowd of 20,000 people. Participants from throughout the world come to honor the tens of thousands of Latin American civilians who have been persecuted, tortured, or killed at the hands of graduates of the school. The participants' goal is to close the school, either by cutting its U.S. funding or by draining the pool of soldiers from countries throughout Latin America, about 1,000 of whom attend classes at the school every year. Organizers have made progress on both fronts this year. Melinda Tuhus reports.
Every year, thousands of students, priests and nuns, veterans, and other social justice advocates descend on Columbus, Georgia. They come for a weekend of workshops, music, puppetry, and a solemn commemoration of those who have died at the hands of graduates of the school, now called the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, or WINSEC. More than 170 people have spent a total of 78 years in jail for trespassing onto the base to protest the military training soldiers receive there. Many people have come year after year, drawn to the inspiration and intense camaraderie to be found outside the gates. Molly Wheeler is one of them. She has a special connection to one of the small number of North Americans who've paid with their lives for standing with the poor of Latin America.
My mother was a Mary Knoll nun and had been the same year as Eda Ford and had known Eda Ford and Maura Clark quite well, the two of the four church women that were killed in El Salvador, December 2nd, 1980. So that was just part of kind of the landscape of growing up.
Wheeler went for the first time last year and headed down again yesterday from New Haven, Connecticut. She describes what drew her back.
It's pretty heartbreaking on one hand because there's people there that have been tortured or have lost family members at the hands of the SOA. And you hear these stories and you bear witness to these people's experience. But on the other hand, it's very uplifting to know that so many people will travel to the middle of nowhere. Last year there were 19,000, it was the biggest crowd ever. And that people would travel that far to demand some action.
SOA Watch staffer Joao da Silva says in recent years, SOA Watch founder Father Roy Bourgeois and others have led delegations to many Latin American countries, asking their leaders to stop sending soldiers to WINSEC for training. Not surprisingly, Venezuela, under President Hugo Chavez, was the first to do so, followed by the leaders of Argentina and Uruguay. Da Silva says that Bolivian President Evo Morales has also talked about removing troops from WINSEC. Morales himself suffered repression and human rights abuses under a former Bolivian dictator trained at the SOA.
The same thing was said by the Minister of Defense in Chile, who said she would recommend the military to stop sending troops. The issue is that the militaries in South America still hold a lot of power and a lot of influence, so it's very challenging to, you know, to propose to leaders of these nations to demand from their militaries to stop sending troops.
Seven Latin American countries will be holding simultaneous events this weekend to protest militarism in Latin America and U.S. foreign policy and to call for closing SOA WINSEC. They are Chile, Argentina, Bolivia, Ecuador, El Salvador, Paraguay, and Colombia. Almost all countries ruled by U.S.-supported military dictatorships in the 1970s and 1980s that practiced widespread torture, rape, and murder of their own citizens. In recent years, democracy has broken out across the continent, and for some of these governments to continue sending their soldiers to a U.S. training center, some of whose more recent graduates have also committed human rights abuses, seems anomalous. In recent years, the countries sending the most soldiers for training are Colombia and Mexico. WINSEC's website states that its mission is to promote peace, democratic values, and respect for human rights through inter-American cooperation. But critics say it promotes military control of civilian populations, often through intimidation and outright violence. As inspiring as the actions at Fort Benning are, the real goal of the work is to shut down the school. To that end, thousands of SOA Watch supporters campaign year-round, sending letters to elected officials and lobbying in Washington. A bill has been introduced in Congress almost every year to cut U.S. funding. Last year, it lost by 15 votes in the House. But 20 opponents of the bill to cut the funding lost their seats in this month's election. No one knows yet how their replacements would vote, but De Silva is optimistic that the new Congress may vote to approve the bill when it's introduced next year.
We're definitely going to target all the new members of the House and the new members of the Senate.
For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
As Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak and Jordanian Prime Minister Maruf al-Bakit signed into agreement a memorandum of understanding covering 17 key areas of trade, social development, and media cooperation yesterday in Jordan's capital of Amman, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters wrapped up its 9th World Conference. Community radio broadcasters from more than 94 countries attended the event to analyze and explore the challenges facing community radio. FSRN's Jackson Ellers reports from Amman.
Although definitions of community radio differ from country to country, one thing that was clear during the 9th World Conference of AMARC, the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, was that grassroots radio is a force to be reckoned with in the 21st century. Early in the week, conference organizers issued a statement affirming what they described was a fundamental right for people in every social and economic strata to have equal access to information. It was among the major themes of the conference. Kolowenyoni is an advocacy officer with a community radio initiative, Radio Dialogue Bulawayo, in Zimbabwe. Like many conference attendees, she said that the existence of bottom-up forms of broadcast mediums that provide for public service are more myth than reality.
People in Zimbabwe do not own the radio. Radio is brought to them by someone. Content is determined for them. They never really do have the platform to speak about issues that affect them. And speaking out in Zimbabwe is really closed. And we have laws like the Public Order and Security Act. For 5 people to gather and discuss an issue, you need to notify the police.
Daoud Kutab is the founder of the Arab world's first community radio station, AmanNet. AmanNet, which started as an internet radio station in 2000, hosted this year's 9th Association of World Radio Broadcasters Conference. Although most of the Arab world has traditionally put tight clamps on its broadcast media, AmanNet has the support of the Jordanian monarchy. But AmanNet's founder, Kutab, said that there is no guarantee that they won't face problems in the future.
I don't think we give them a lot of clear-cut excuses to kind of close us down. If they would do it arbitrarily, I think they would suffer. I don't know. We've been okay with them, and they seem to be okay with us. They're logically, we don't have an axe to grind against anybody except anybody who messes up the public. We defend the public. We are community radio, and our role is to defend the community.
Indeed, community radio worldwide, both in highly industrialized countries like the United States and in the developing world, face continuing pressure by governments attempting to control the dissemination of information, this according to AMARC organizers. Zain Ibrahim, founder of South Africa's first community radio station, Bush Radio, and described by many as the godfather of African community radio, says that much of these problems can be solved by how community radio is presented to those in power.
You go to an Arab country like Libya, Tunisia, and talk to them about freedom of speech, you're out the door so fast your head will spin. But you talk to them about saving money, developing the people's dignity, about poverty reduction, environmental issues. Do you want to save money on health? Aha! I tell you how. Community radio.
The 10th AMARC World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters Conference is scheduled to be held in Latin America in 2010. With help from Norm Stockwell and Andrew Stelzer, this is Jackson Allers reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Amman, Jordan.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News from KPFK in Los Angeles. I'm Laura Bogado.